Welcome to a full-length edition of the Reaction Podcast. I'm Alistair Benn, and I'm joined by Ian Martin, editor of Reaction, and our executive editor, Maggie Pagano. This week, we're going to talk about coronavirus, which, according to the Times in a poll, is the most read-about news story of the last sort of 15 years or so, even bigger than any terror attack in that time and everything else. But first off, Ian is going to introduce an offer we've got for our readers.
Yes. If you're listening to this podcast and you're not a subscriber to Reaction, well, it usually costs £52 for the year. And our wonderful subscribers are being very tolerant and accepting that we're doing a half price offer for new subscribers. So you go to the site www.reaction.life. You click on subscribe and it's only £26. And for that, you get full access to the site. You get my weekly newsletter on politics and all manner of other things. And you get all access to all the brilliant writing from the Reaction team. And a lot of people are making sacrifices, writers, friends of Reaction who are chipping in. We've dramatically increased our coverage. We know through traffic figures, a lot more people are reading the site. So thank you very much. But if you want to support our journalism and get more of it, become a Reaction subscriber. Anyway, that's the advert over, Alistair. Back to you.
Thank you. So, I mentioned the Times. I can't remember, it was some modelling they'd done on what stories kind of people talked about. Coronavirus comes out sort of astonishing 98%, 99%. I mean, astonishing that 1% of the population hasn't talked about coronavirus. But weirdly, about 15% of the population seemed to not know what Brexit was.
Lucky them.
Yeah, I know. Fair enough.
Maybe they knew what it was, and the events of the last few weeks have made them just forget.
Yes.
Just by putting it all in context. It does also seem to be, it's very interesting what's happening in media terms. I mean, there's a lot going wrong for the media as well, because it's difficult to print newspapers, or you can print newspapers, but difficult when people are not going out or not going to shops in the same way. But the best media have responded by scaling up coverage. And there does seem to be an extraordinary interest from readers. And there don't really seem to be the evidence, looking at the way that search is working and what's being read by people, is they don't really want, this is too serious, they don't really want stuff that is hyped, or it's almost impossible, it just looks ridiculous, something being exaggerated. Now, people seem to want, and this is encouraging in terms of media tastes and habits and what it says about the population at large, is that they seem to want accurate, well-presented, clearly written and presented stuff, which explains what the hell is going on and presents the latest on testing and stories from around the world, and media outlets that do that are doing well.
Yeah, no, it really does feel like the cut and thrust is a bit irrelevant. Sorry, Maggie.
I was just going to say, I think they want what journalism really is all about, which is people asking questions and hopefully on issues. It's so complex, isn't it? And indeed, people don't really know all the facts. So asking questions about testing, how it works, who's making it, why haven't we got more? I think that's really what people are desperate to find out about.
So, Alistair, where are we, do you think, on the testing and the latest? Deal with Britain primarily first, just in that you watched, or we all watched, I'm sure, now national pastime, watching the early evening briefing from Downing Street. What did you make of what you heard?
So I think there are two different things that we need to say about testing. On the one hand, the government is scaling up testing by, within the broad margins of what different countries in the West are doing on testing. The British government is doing more testing than some other places, but it's scaled up its testing. It scaled it up as a strategy to fight the disease in the clinical, on the clinical side. So it's testing for NHS workers. The reason I think why testing, I mean, the number of cases, testing basically stopped being done in the community. And about a week and a half ago, I think, it's only been doing on hospitals for people who are suspected of having COVID, coronavirus, is a clinical strategy. If you know that someone has coronavirus, you can treat them with, you know, the best available knowledge that you have, because coronavirus presents in a very similar way to lots of other respiratory problems. I mean, lots of things become pneumonia, for example. All kinds of illnesses can generate secondary infections, etc. But the other side of testing is to understand where the disease is at a national level, and to gauge, you know, whether, you know, how many people have it, and whether we can start moving to a different phase in the lockdown and in the kind of mitigation and containment strategies. But that phase isn't what I think the government is as interested in at the moment as I think some of the media are. And I am, because I want to know where the disease is, and I want to know who's had it. And I want, you know, as a observer, someone who's interested in the health of people, I want to know, you know, maybe I've had it, I don't know. So, but that's a completely different issue. And I think the government has been right to focus on the clinical stuff, because at the moment they're fighting the scaling up of the disease in hospitals. And if that is generated with, and if that limits the number of people dying, then that's a good thing. But I think the next few weeks it'll change, and we'll have a, you know, we'll see it move, we'll move on to antibodies and all the rest. But the absolute priority clearly is for NHS workers to know that they're fit for work.
But I think on the antibodies front is that they're not entirely sure of the accuracy of testing, and they're still working on that. So it's not that they're not doing it at scale. And as Yvonne, the deputy, I've forgotten her correct title, but was speaking at the press conference, was saying, there's not, it reminded me of Theresa May and Brexit actually, says there's nothing worse than a bad test. And that's absolutely right. And we know of Randox Health, for example, who are flat out manufacturing. They do have a test that works flat out, but other manufacturers are still at the testing stage.
But just on the main, just on the main test, as compared to the antibody test, I mean, the question was posed at the press conference, and it has been posed several times of the government. I haven't yet really seen an adequate explanation or account, and I know it's very difficult to actually get to the bottom of this, but the German situation where they are testing 500,000 people per week, and that our, I thought the answer from Valence was really unsatisfactory on this today. He was, he looked embarrassed, and I do suspect that the government is slightly embarrassed about what this has revealed about our testing capacity and why the German system is so much better. But Maggie, did you, was I missing something about it? Just, it's such a gulf in terms of numbers.
No, you're right. And I don't think there is. What are we doing? 25,000 and the Germans 500. No, nobody has adequately explained. I mean, fine if there's a manufacturing problem or they put in the orders too late, but I think they ought to be upfront with people. Because in a sense, if you know what the problem was, you can hopefully be working on a solution. Whereas if they just don't give an answer, it's sort of very jellyish, isn't it? And leaves
there do seem to be shortages in terms of some of the chemicals or reagents, so it is suggested. And I think Jack Dickens, who's been brilliant throughout this for us on testing and related questions, is working on a piece specifically on the German example and explaining some of what's been going on. So there'll be something on the site this evening or tomorrow morning on that subject. But it, you're right, Alistair, this comes in two parts, doesn't it? There is this, there's the short-term April question, which is really all about the NHS, how much can it take, and that is the peak flattened to an extent that it, that the system can, although it's going to be very, very difficult, can the system cope? So you get that's the story really for the next 4 to 5 weeks. It's going to be very, very difficult, and you just wish everyone involved the best.
Yes.
But beyond that, when you get into May, those questions, you know, how do we test more in future? How do things like the vulnerable list work? All of the stuff which has been improvised and patched together in the last couple of months, is that there's going to be a public clamor, isn't there, for a much better plan for next time. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think absolutely. And we'll, I mean, from what Jack has, I don't want to preempt his piece, but from what he said about the Germany scenarios, that they do have a peculiar institutional setup which makes them relatively better prepared to combat pandemic type illnesses. But I mean, just a quick rollback on testing in hospitals. I've spoken to some, I know the people I know are junior doctors, basically at my age, will tell you that the problem isn't that the government has been trying to increase the number of testing, but it is a supply problem, really. And there is a global shortage of some of the materials that go into it. So that complicates it. I think the reason that there was a very significant change of rationale, that they were going to scale up testing in hospitals and on the clinical side. And that's why fewer tests, I think, have been done relatively. But clearly, there haven't been enough in hospitals because people have still, you hear anecdotes about people not feeling that they have enough access to it. But I understand the rationale. You do not want every Tom, Dick and Harry ringing up NHS 111 trying to acquire a test or lying to their GP about symptoms or whatever, because people are desperate to understand this disease. And it's not just governments, it's individuals, and are desperately trying to work out what's happening around them. So I think that it's complicated, I think, by the human factor, as well. But anyway, I think
there'll be lots more to write and write on this subject in the weeks and months ahead. But what does a post crisis plan look like? By which I mean preparing for second wave or reappearance or a mutation or something. Does it look like, and there's a lot of screaming and shouting, how come Taiwan and South Korea have got this right? And we've explored this on podcasts before. We know why. It's because they've had various brushes with death on pandemics, and the political impact of the SARS emergency means that they had it very controversial in South Korea. There's a live political question: is the government doing enough in terms of pandemic preparedness? But that's the reason that they have, in many of these countries, closer to China, they are primed for it and are ready to go with testing, with temperature tests in major buildings and in restaurants, and then with mobile testing units and quarantine orders and all the stuff that we've seen. They didn't just decide to develop this in early January, ahead of the just ahead of the curve. This has been in place for a long time. Are we going to need, do you think, Maggie, something similar? Won't there be a public clamour for that scale of public preparedness as early as the summer?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, as you pose the question, what happens, and Dr. Jenny Harris alluded to this almost two-phase period, if they can see it's come down, then certain key people can return, but they'll only be able to do that once all those antibody testing. So it would be, and they're right to say 6 months, it's going to be a slow process. And then I think we're going to become much more like the Asians. You can understand now when they visit London why everybody wears masks. I think to us it seemed a rather sort of bizarre fact, but now you can understand why it became commonplace in their society. And yes, I think we will. And if it really is going to take between 6 months and a year for a credible vaccine, which is what they're saying, then I think that clamour will continue.
It's also there's real Western arrogance and self-delusion about this particular, that masks question keeps coming back to me. Several of the pieces I've read about the culture of these things in Japan or in South Korea, that it's only a month ago that people were writing and saying, look at the ridiculous spectacle of people wearing masks on the tube. It doesn't help. It doesn't make any difference. It's a nonsensical sort of Asian import. Mm. Well, it turns out it does make a difference, but it seems to make in Asian societies, it seems to make a difference, not simply just on, it's not just the pure medical aspect. It's the signal which it sends. It sends a signal to your fellow passengers to avoid or keep your distance. And it also sends a message, a reassuring message, which is I care about the health of my fellow citizens. Mm-hmm. And it's if you then see lots of people wearing masks on the tube in Tokyo, for example, or in the South Korean city, they are sending out. It's not necessarily a selfish message, I don't want to catch this. It is indicating we're in a state of heightened awareness and heightened alert. Take it seriously. Mm. So I think we're clearly going to have to move to something like that, combined with a much more coherent government response. I think there's been an excess of criticism, particularly in the last few weeks. There will come a time for a public inquiry, but it's going to be fascinating to see how quickly or not the government machine and Public Health England, different in Scotland and Northern Ireland, but Public Health England, Chief Medical Officer Simon Stevens, the NHS England, how quickly they'll be exhausted just from fighting this in April, but then there will be a public demand by May, June, to outline what's the plan for next time.
Yeah. But do you think individual behaviour will change as a consequence, don't you? I mean, heard one professor on a radio programme last week saying actually the number of food poisoning cases will have just be down on the floor now because people are being so much cleaner, wiping everything. You know, there's actually a lot that we could have done before, so maybe this is going to wake up a lot of people up into their personal hygiene approach.
What do we think on the civil liberties question? We had a very good piece from Rachel Cunliffe this morning about the police and the attitude that some police forces are taking, and it's expressed on Twitter, these ludicrous tweets with very often with spelling mistakes included as well, urging people to do stuff in a rather sort of draconian nanny state way that reminds me of Dad's Army, really.
Yeah.
Put that light out culture. But I wanted to firstly to ask you, Alistair, in our morning meeting, news meeting this morning, you were annoyed about this.
I think I was annoyed because I'm cooped up in my house the whole time, and it's easy to get frustrated, I think, when you see Warrington Police Force gleefully tweeting that they've, can't remember exactly which police force, but tweeting things like, we've nabbed someone who was on a non-essential drive. I mean, police force tweeting Stephen Kinnock to not go and visit his dad, even though he was just delivering food. So that stuff is clearly enormously frustrating. And it also chimes with a classic stereotype about the English, is that they're curtain twitchers and that suburbia is full of neurotic types who would like nothing more than to shock their neighbours who they resent for some weird reason to the police or someone else. So there's a kind of that cultural trope about authority and the English, it kind of resonates. But I think the annoying thing and the frustrating thing about this is that we should be trusted to some extent to enforce these things ourselves, and only then can they really be seen to be legitimate for a long, long time, which is exactly what you were talking about with the mask idea and people being generally more careful. So that stuff, if that doesn't emerge properly, but I think it has done, I think people are self-censored massively and are very wary of what's going on. And you look at the figures that were presented at the press conference today in terms of use of travel use, which were completely down in London, for example. But I'd like to contrast that with the howls of outrage that people were making when London travel was only down by a certain number about 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Behaviour does not change very as fast as that. And it's, I think, irresponsible to sort of upbraid people for not changing fast enough or as fast as you think is necessary. Because that immediately severs that and makes the conversation harder to have because everyone gets pissed off and angry. And also, and another thing it all connects with is disease, our fear of contamination and our fear of it are deeply constitutive of how we relate to people. I wrote an essay about this about a month ago for Reaction about where the fear of disease comes from. The Greeks were obsessed with the idea that silent things could move through the air. They associated it with, particularly male writers associated it with Pandora, woman. So femininity was seen as a disease for man that he had to deal with. You know, it's all kind of rooted in there. And I think the moment the state kind of gives license for everyone to police other people's or license for everyone to kind of snipe at everyone else, then it unleashes all kinds of nasty things.
I think that's exactly what's informed Boris's thinking about this, because his instincts are towards that kind of liberal approach, or it's a liberal Toryism. I thought there was a fascinating moment in the press conferences, one of the press conferences just before he got ill, when he was being asked whether he should impose stricter measures, and quite a few of our listeners and readers, I'm sure, think that he should have moved earlier. But the reporter, forgive me, I can't remember who it was, snapped about sending in the army and the police, and sending in the police and sending in the army.
Yeah.
And Boris smirked and said, "The police." But his instinct is, thank goodness, as Ben Kelly wrote for us, is liberal. You don't send in the police. The police are us. The police are part of the community. In the particularly English tradition of policing, which comes from Peel's notion of policing by consent, they are drawn from the community. You can't send them in. They're here already, and they live and work among us as civilians.
Yeah.
So I think his instincts in this are absolutely right and in tune with where certainly England is, and what that balance between questions of liberty and the need to enforce strict rules. There is a real backlash building. You heard Jonathan Sumption on, for those who heard him on, I think on Radio 4 lunchtime today, lots of people were very pleased that he'd spoken up. Some thought he was talking complete rubbish as well, but he was making a point about liberty and how easily liberty had been given up. The parliament didn't really do anything, the media hasn't really objected, and the police forces are interpreting, rather than following law, are interpreting instructions from the government, which don't, for the most part, carry the effect of law, although there's a lot in the civil contingency legislation and in the coronavirus bill. But he was identifying something that a real risk. I'm not sure I'd go as far as Sumption, but you're going to see more of it, don't you think, Maggie, in the weeks ahead as we're stuck at home? And I think should be stuck at home, speaking as someone who's isolating, but still there's a tension there.
There's a huge tension, and it's a very, very fine balance, isn't it? And on one hand, you have the sort of ridiculousness of the Derby police who put the dye in the lagoon. I mean that really was Dad's army, and they were the fools.
Actually, I initially got really annoyed about that story. It's a really interesting story. Is that, and I don't want to impugn the reporter, But apparently, it's not true.
Ah, well, I hope not.
Apparently,
I really hope not.
It went viral. It went
mad.
And I was curious about it, along with millions of other people.
Yeah.
Apparently, and someone can maybe get in touch locally if I'm incorrect in saying this. Apparently, it's always been done. It's been done for years. It's because the water is not safe. I can't remember if it's copper or something is in the water. And they've done it on and off for ages. And it's simply, they do it ahead of spring and summer to remind people not to swim. And this was reported as a coronavirus warning.
But we need the truth. We need a story verifying this. That will be on reaction tomorrow, listener. But it's true, because that showed the sort of nonsensical side of it. I think there's also there's something else here that is very important, and that is, Alistair, you said it yourself, you're cooped up in your house, and yet we can see others who are driving their cars in the Lake District or in beautiful scenic, who have the luxury of going out. But in a sense, I think there's a sort of sense of guilt that you shouldn't be going out and enjoying yourself. I know a lot of people who have dogs, and they don't know whether should they be allowed to go off a couple of miles to the parks or the, you know, forests where they usually go, or not. And I think so. And nobody's really been told, have they? Which is why the police could say it was non-essential. So maybe we need more guidelines, but then at the same time we need to be able to interpret these things ourselves. I don't know, I think it's a tricky one, but I think maybe Jonathan Sumption went a little bit far. The English are not, the English are, what's the word? We are anarchist by nature, I think. And I don't think there's any worry about any authoritarian state.
Yeah.
And going back to Boris, I mean, if you remember back to prorogation, the great fear was, oh, we've got this dictator, we've got this fascist right-wing government. Yeah. And there was Boris last week. He couldn't even bring himself to say the word military, could he? Such as this is, you know, nature. So I thought that was quite funny, quite a paradox there. Yeah.
Well, Sumption sort of indicated, I mean, he made that contrast, as you said, Ian, between the citizenry in England, where police are, you know, just another person who has that responsibility. And then he talks about the police as a wing of government, interpreting the whims of ministers, and which, you know, I think that characterization is mostly true. But obviously he's implicitly contrasting the English way with what other countries do, basically. And you look at France, there is a, you know, you look at some of the various departments in the French police, whether it's the CRS or whatever, and you probably would describe them as pretty hardcore types. But that doesn't mean that the French are not already champing at the bit to violate some of the measures that have come in. I think there is already in France a growing antipathy to the authoritarianism, and they're having to clamp down more and more. There's a great piece in The Spectator last week about this, and it's I think the government was absolutely right to ignore armchair generals like Rory Stewart, who were advising us to lock down about a month and a half ago, because it's very hard to maintain consent for the kinds of measures we're now seeing, and it's pretty hard. I think the broad public consent that was there in terms of the polling, up to 90 to 95% of the public agreeing that there should be a lockdown, that was contingent on the sense that cases were spiralling out of control, pressure on the NHS was getting far worse. We'll have to review, but yeah. I think 2 weeks ago, if they tried to do this, already we'd have seen a massively concentrated backlash to what's happening. And luckily it hasn't happened so far.
But we're also going to get this tested in real time, with certain countries providing control groups. You're going to see how the approach in Sweden, where Sweden is still open really with certain restrictions, or Holland, where they've taken an approach which is more like the herd immunity approach that Britain was trying or wasn't trying Well, let's wait and find out exactly what the government thought it was doing. But they've been quite explicit about that, that the Dutch Prime Minister and his main advisor have used the term herd immunity quite recently, and others are others, particularly on the left, are demanding much stricter controls. And then, of course, you have Belarus, where the father of the nation says that it can all be sorted by, was it vodka and tractors?
And saunas.
That everything can be sold by vodka and tractors, and that if you get out in the fields and work with your tractor and get out in the open air and you drink lots of vodka, that'll see off the coronavirus. So that's all about to be tested as well. Should we just a very quick word on the US? It's almost the subject of a podcast on its own, and we'll maybe try and get one of our American friends to join the podcast next week and tell us what they think is happening. Situation in New York looks as though it's going to be the big story this week. Absolutely horrifying story unfolding.
Yeah.
But Trump's ratings are still up, but then every leader's ratings are up globally. That's what tends to happen in a crisis, is the leader's ratings go up. Yeah. As someone who likes America so much, I can barely even watch the American networks at the moment. I'm so worried about America.
Yeah. But it also, because obesity seems to, again, I'm not obviously no expert, but obesity comes up again and again as one of those exacerbating factors.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's well known that there is a problem.
Yes.
And also the health, it seems that the health is so uneven, which is, again, it's going to make it harder to deal with.
But. Yeah. Can we talk a bit about, Maggie, about the banks and specifically the rescue programs, which there are lots of reports of people struggling to access and it taking days to get in touch. What's your assessment of where we are?
Two things. One is clearly the volume is enormous, so the whole processing is going to take a long time. But what one is hearing from several people who've made these applications is that the applications, number one, are taking 7 days to go through. So we've had, 10 days of this now. But they're not getting any response. And there are serious worries that the banks, which will only which have to take 20% of the risk of these loans, are asking for personal guarantees and also forecasts of what the future profits might be of the business. Now, the whole point of this scheme was to underwrite the business today, and it was to save jobs today. Mm. Any business can go bust in 6 months. It's ludicrous to try and give any forecast. And I think that, and I've said this before, that the Chancellor and possibly the Prime Minister need to bring in the heads of the clearing banks and remind them who helped them out during the financial crash, and say, just even if there are some who slip through who perhaps shouldn't have got them, rather like the self-employed problem, they've just got to approve it. Otherwise, there's no point having this scheme at all.
Because the people are in a queue to get to speak to someone, and they put in what effectively most of the major banks, as I understand it, are asking people for last quarter number and full numbers, obviously the previous year's full accounts, a best case and a worst case scenario. It shouldn't be that difficult, particularly when the loans are 80% underwritten by the government, by the taxpayer. It shouldn't be that difficult to calculate. If someone had a profitable business in the previous year and a large chunk of their revenue, which is easily quantified, is wiped out, certainly for the next three to six months, that if you get back to normal life or something approaching it, as long as they're not trying to borrow an enormous sum, say equivalent to their entire turnover or something, if they're borrowing say a quarter of the or a fifth of projected revenue to help them get to the other side, and can then clearly, once they become profitable, they're in a position to then repay. I don't understand why that is such a difficult ask, but it may But you don't think, Maggie, just that the banks are themselves just struggling with the weight of it, and they have staff who are ill themselves? Is it just?
No, absolutely. I think it could well be a volume. Pressure? Yeah, I think it's probably a volume issue. The same with universal credit, which I think the number of applications was sort of 450,000 in one day. So, and I think everyone's doing a fantastic job doing this stuff from home. But even so, they need a kick, don't they? Because if these loans are not approved really within the next two to three weeks, the businesses are dead. And then the state will still have to pay that, because everyone will then apply for universal credit and welfare benefits. So with one hand they take away and give with the other. So,
and you've then also, those businesses are then destroyed. They return to zero unless the brand has some residual value, which in the case of a lot of small businesses it just won't. Once it's gone, it's gone, and those people will then have to start again or look for employment in what's going to be a quite crowded marketplace. Do you think, though, Maggie, that you said that need to get the banks in? Do you think it's time for a bit of a bully pulpit moment from the governor of the Bank of England or the Chancellor?
I
feel that business people I speak to are in this situation. People are desperately worried. These are businesses which are very viable until a few weeks ago. If their revenues have just completely dried up,
which they have. Imagine if you're a small restaurant or hairdresser or whatever. You would be technically broke. And the idea that most these businesses have savings for the next few months is also nonsense. I think that Andrew Bailey, who has great experience, he used to run the Prudential Regulatory Authority, so he knows these banks, he knows them all on first name terms. This is where not so much the old lady's eyebrow, but I think a little bit of a kick from the governor is needed.
And
they've got to, you know, it's a bureaucratic process, but unless the person at the top makes a strict instructions all the way down the line, and as I say, if there are a few that get through that might have done well, that's a marginal cost, isn't it, in the scheme of things?
Yeah, you feel that, and it's actually a little while since this was launched by the government, and they've been praised a lot in the abstract for the fact that the program exists, and it clearly is a sensible, welcome thing. I'm not knocking that at all, but we're a week now since Rishi Sunak said that it would be open for business and in place, and a lot of people are in the queue, and they're at month end, and then who knows what the hell happens in April. It feels to me that it needs whether it's a recorded message or a joint press conference from the governor and the chancellor, who I don't think have been seen. They've been seen together, but I don't think they've done a joint event.
They haven't, no.
Just telling people, business people, employees and owners of businesses, help is on the way. It might take a few days. We understand this, and we have spoken to the banks, and they are under instructions to lend. I mean, they are also, the banks are awash with money.
Indeed.
We know that.
They're set to pay out in total, is it about 75 billion in dividends? I mean, they
7.5 billion, I think. Yeah.
7.5 billion, thank you. There's absolutely no reason. They've had fantastic capital buffers for the last few years. They've got more than enough. But one has to remember that banks traditionally don't lend to small businesses. They don't really like small businesses, and that non-banking finance is actually their main source. So alternative finance, there's 60 billion sitting in ISAs. You know, there's a lot of money around. We just need to find the right conduits to get it to the small businesses, and quickly.
I think that's of a piece with a very good report out today by the Social Market Foundation, James Kirkup's think tank, which describes this in terms of a new compact being needed post-crisis between business and society. Now, that will horrify some of our more free market listeners, or maybe not after this crisis, but people are going to remember afterwards who helped and who didn't, and who was opportunistic and who really took their social responsibility seriously. So the banks have, I think, they have a duty if they're part of our society and they benefit from effectively being underwritten by the state, and they benefit from association, from being clearing banks with the Bank of England, then they have an obligation, and I think it's time for them to step up. Because I think that the initial feeling that people were reassured now needs to be matched. And if it's not in the next week to 10 days, I think they'll have serious problems on their hands.
But two quick points, really quick points, Ian. One is, in a sense, people have never forgiven the bankers post the crash. Nobody went to jail. Nobody was really punished. People soon got back to their huge bonuses and whatever. This is their chance to redeem themselves. This is the chance to say, yeah, we weren't the bad boys. Now we're the good boys, and we're going to do everything we can. And I think that's absolutely right about New Compact. And
I think they've been quite good at the banks, if they were, senior people listening into this, I think they would argue that they've been really quite good in terms of retail customers, and they have been bombarding people with texts and saying, you know, we've got your back on this, and offering them help on credit cards and all of that sort of stuff. But business seems to be more difficult, maybe for the reason that you described there, Maggie, that they're just not built to do it.
But even if they could just give them the confidence that it's in the pipeline, I think that it's all about confidence now. People's mental health is very fragile. You're at home and you're losing your business, you know? So they could certainly get it up. Right.
Well, I think we'll probably wrap it up there for this week, shall we, gang? I think until we'll come back with a rapid reaction podcast tomorrow or the next day. Let's see how the news agenda develops. There's lots we didn't talk about. We haven't talked about what the hell is going on in the Eurozone, which is endlessly interesting as well. And there's the American situation. So we will be back with a rapid reaction podcast. Just to reiterate, if you're not a Reaction subscriber, it's really easy to become a subscriber and support all the brilliant journalism that the team do. It's only £26 for the year. Go to the site www.reaction.life, become a Reaction subscriber. Until next time, thank you for listening.
Thank you.